Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the Deadwood Mountain Grand in Deadwood for the South Dakota Festival of Books. We have a wonderful audience here, standing room only, in our little corner of the world. And sitting with me at the table, Megan Phelps Roper has a new book coming out called Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. Maybe that's all we have to say to introduce that book. It released on Tuesday.
Right.
All right. Welcome. Tuesday coming. So thank you for being here with us. This is one of your first radio interviews about this book, but it will not be the last. You have a lot planned coming up.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the response to the release of this book and some of the anticipation that you're feeling as an author.
Wow. The response so far has been really positive. I think people have an image of Westboro, which is largely, almost entirely my family, my extended family. It was started by my grandfather. I think people have this image of them as these crazed doomsayers and as sort of monstrous people who are, you know, deliberately doing things that they know are wrong. And I think my book shows other sides of them that are largely hidden from outsiders.
This is a book largely about empathy, in the sense that your own journey toward learning empathy for the people that you're speaking out with hatred toward. And also from people who don't know this family, seeing them as, you know, parent mothers, fathers, people who read stories to you, people who kiss you when you fall down. I know I was partway into it, and I had to flip back to the cover, and I was like, oh, loving and leaving. and I paused for a minute because I was wondering if that empathy is misplaced and if people have said to you, is that the best place for your empathy to fall at this time?
Yes. So, yes, people have absolutely made that argument that, you know, that maybe we should be focusing exclusively on the victims and targets of groups like Westboro. And I completely understand that, and I absolutely do believe that those people deserve our empathy and attention and anything that we can do to help those groups. The part about, you know, I was changed by people who had empathy for me, even though, you know, you could absolutely argue that I didn't deserve anything. I didn't deserve anything but the hostility and provocation that was directed, you know, my way. But that never changed me. The shaming and the yelling and the screaming and, you know, people driving their cars at us, that confirmed the narrative that I was taught from the time I was a child, that outsiders were evil and going to hell. The people who changed my mind and turned me from somebody who was actively doing harm to other people to now an advocate for grace and for equality and compassion, they were people who had compassion on me, who took into account the fact that I had been indoctrinated into this belief system from the time I was old enough to understand words. And their willingness to reach out to me is what changed things. So now, not only am I doing the work to try to help these people that Westboro targets and groups like them, but I'm not now actively doing those things. So it's like there is a lot of good that can come out of reaching out to people in these groups.
And as we talk about this book, we should let listeners know there's some tough language in here because of the nature of what Westboro Baptist Church still does. Things that we're going to use some of that language here in this conversation. Tell me the first time people start bringing signs to, you know, you're like 5 years old when you're, you know, you're on the picket line, and those signs, you have your favorite signs. Tell me what some of your favorite signs were as a child.
Oh, man.
Because you're 5 years old now.
Yeah, I mean, some of the earliest signs we were using were, gays are worthy of death. And then, you know, eventually we got to what has become their most famous message, which is God hates fags. That's their website. You know, there's a lot of really, you know, terrible language that I was taught, you know, from the time I was a kid, that this is how we should be talking about people who are abominable in the sight of God. So we were taught that this was not our hatred. This was the hatred of God, and that in fact it was a loving thing for us to go out and warn people that they were doing wrong.
To rebuke.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
What is the nature of rebuking? Right. And the word fag is used because it specifically talks about something that is fuel for hell.
Right.
So this is a stick that burns, and therefore
Right, this a literal,
is, this
yeah.
is a literal thing to say, this is what needs to happen to you. This right. is what's happening to those who have died.
Right, yeah. A literal faggot is used to fuel the fires of nature. It's used for kindling. And so we used that word as saying that there are passages in the New Testament that talk about gays, how they burn in their lust one toward another, and then fuel the fires of God's wrath and fuel the fires of hell. So using that language even was considered essential by the church because they said gay was a misnomer.
You go to school, you read books, you go to the library, you watch television, you're in the school, there's a teacher who's Jewish, you have things to say about that, but you have friends. A lot of people think that in order for this there's some compound somewhere where there's nothing is let in or let out, but it's this culture is permeable. I mean, you move freely between the two cultures.
Yes, absolutely. And that it's something that I think people have a hard time understanding, like how could you be exposed to these ideas and not be changed by them? And the only way I can answer that is by explaining the experience of being at home with people that I loved and who every single day was, we were reading the Bible together, talking about current events and things that were happening in the world in light of the church's understanding of Scripture, and being constantly told about outsiders, how these people hate each other, they hate God, so even as we are being exposed to them, we have already been, the analogy that I use is that it's like being inoculated against those ideas and any reaching out by those people because they are evil. The mindset is so black and white, it is so us versus them, that there was just, I could not see outside of it, until I got on Twitter.
Let's talk about Twitter, and let's talk about social media, because the New Yorker did a column about World AIDS Day, and your tweet is, and everything's highlighted in red on World AIDS Day, and yours is "Thank God for AIDS." That's how you're using. So how do you kind of come into the world of social media and Twitter and see at first the power to spread the Westboro message even further, and then let's transition into how other people see it as an opportunity to invite you into a different mindset?
Westboro is extremely active. So the reason people think that it's actually only a group of about 70 to 80 people, but people have this image of them as being kind of larger than life because they're all over the place. We were actively going, traveling across the country. We picketed every single day for a couple of hours in my hometown, Topeka, Kansas, but any tool that we could find to spread this message, because again, we thought this was loving our neighbor. So it was all consuming, the desire to spread this message. And so when I read an article about Twitter, I thought, okay, well, this is something else that I can do. And at that point I was like 20, 22, 23. This is someplace we can go to spread this message. And because of the nature of Twitter, you get on and, it doesn't take very long. You're limited to, at that point, it was 140 characters. And Westboro's message, it is tailored for something like Twitter. We used 3 to 5 words on a picket sign. So 140 characters was actually quite a bit more. So I got on there, spreading that message, and it immediately got a lot of attention and a lot of hostility, which is exactly the kind of response that I had expected, because it was the same response that I'd gotten on the picket line all my life. And then almost immediately, it shocks me now looking back, because yes, you mentioned World AIDS Day, so that's December 1st. I got on Twitter in 2009, so that's December 1st, 2009, was a few months after I started tweeting for the church. And even at that point, I had already started having these conversations that would eventually change my heart and mind and help me see outside of this paradigm that I had been taught was unquestionable, the literal and infallible word of God that could not be doubted. And so anyway, so I started having these conversations, and initially it is universally, full of that kind of hostility and provocation. But almost immediately people started to see that I was sincere, that I really believed. I would be constantly quoting the Bible and saying, this is the truth of God, we have no standing to question this. And so then they started asking questions. And over time, the fact that, there were several things about Twitter that made it different from anything that I'd encountered before. it allowed me to develop rapport with people over time, even though, and it, because it was in this very limited way, 140 characters at a time, you know, I felt safe, and I was, I could be vulnerable in a way that I could never be in physical space with other people, because I'd had all these experiences with people. I knew to keep them at arm's length, and interacting with them online, you know, again, it made me feel safe. That distance made me feel like there was some kind of a, you know, a buffer zone, kind of. And then there was several other things about Twitter. The fact that it was 140 characters meant that the very, you know, the insults that my family constantly and casually tossed around all the time, on the picket line, in email, there wasn't space for it. And so that's one part of it. Like, there wasn't space for it, so I just had to stop using them. And then, but there was another aspect to it, which was that when I did include those insults, there was this immediate feedback loop where I could see the conversation immediately go off the rails, because now we're no longer talking about this theological point that I think is so important. Now this is a playground quarrel, and you know, people are saying, you don't know me, and you know, getting really defensive, and so that was frustrating to me, because again, I thought this was so important, it was so valuable, they needed to hear the truth of God. And so all of these things changed the dynamic of the conversation, and that was instrumental in outsiders being able to understand Westboro's ideology with enough nuance to find these internal inconsistencies and contradictions in our theology. My family is full of lawyers. You know, my grandfather was a civil rights pioneer in the state of Kansas, and he required his children and their spouses to go to law school to support him in that work. He got an award from the NAACP and other black civil rights groups, and was kind of the go-to lawyer in those situations. They are not stupid, and they are not deliberately doing what they know is wrong. They are just convinced by these arguments. So I had never, growing up, you know, there was always an answer for everything that we, you know, all the positions that we took. There was always a verse, a Bible verse, that we would, you know, memorize. And, you know, having these arguments on, you know, on the picket line, I never had the sense of, you know, there was always an answer for everything. So I was just certain that we were right. So when these people on Twitter were able to find these contradictions, it was mind-blowing to me. It was the first time in my life that I realized that we could be wrong about something. And it's sort of, you know, the image of Westboro as having, you know, a monopoly on truth, this divine, unquestionable truth. When I came to doubt that in my mind, that was the beginning of the end for me at Westboro.
I want to talk about courage, because as you leave and form a life, and a lot of that, it happens right here in South Dakota, right here in the community of Deadwood, you have choices now. You can change your name and be someone else and leave all this behind. You could oppose your family. You could be a counter-protester. You could help people infiltrate and understand and bring down, you know, depending on what. And instead, you choose to do what you're doing, which is, I mean, this book is going to be huge. I think everybody knows that. And have these difficult conversations. And in doing that, you're going to have to face-to-face people who still believe the old message and who are angry with you and want to argue with you. You will have to face people whose lives you have damaged. So I don't think it's any secret for people who listen to the show that I'm a veteran. Westboro protests veterans' funerals pretty ardently. Mm-hmm. When I'm 5 years old, people are calling my older brother a faggot, throwing things at his head. You and I have to sit down together, and I have to say, your words hurt my family and have affected my family's lives in ways that you'll never understand. And you're brave enough to do that with not just me, but anybody else who's gonna come find you and ask you those questions. One, what do you say to those people? And two, where do you find the courage to not just say, I'm done, I'm out, this is my new life, I'm young, I got lots of life ahead of me. Talk about courage first.
So there was a moment a few months after I left Westboro, and I was in, you know, there was one of the gentlemen that I met on Twitter, became a friend. He was an Orthodox Jew living in Jerusalem. He invited me to this Jewish cultural festival, the Jewlicious Festival, in California. a few months after I left, he was the one who found the first contradiction in the church's ideology. And sitting at, you know, and having these conversations, we were sitting at the Shabbat table of a rabbi who, you know, him and his family, my sister had held a sign that said, "Your rabbi is a whore," 3 years earlier at this exact festival. And, you know, I was sitting there weeping with my sister and talking to David about everything that we had lost. Our family, you know, the only life we'd ever known, our lifelong home. It felt like we had betrayed everything and everyone that we'd ever loved. And we were just terrified. And he said, in a lot of ways, leaving Westboro Baptist Church was the most Westboro Baptist Church thing you could have done. He said, they were the ones, he said, you are your parents' children. They were the ones who taught you to stand up for what you believe in, no matter what it cost you. They just never imagined you'd be standing up to them. I knew, you know, I did know about, you know, your being a veteran, and I understand the pain that we have caused so many people. The idea of walking away from that and of trying to pretend like it didn't happen, all the things that I did as a member of Westboro, and of not trying to make amends and make it right, it never occurred to me because of that upbringing. And that's, I mean, I can only say that it's anything in me, I feel like anything in me that's good is a reflection, or courageous, or whatever word that you want to use, is also a reflection of the family. That, and I think, and a hope that, you know, you can see both sides of that by when you read this book, or, you know, it's complicated because humans are complicated. I don't believe that my family are bad people. I think they do incredibly destructive, and in some cases even evil things. I do believe that the funeral protests especially, I do believe those things, that was and is evil. But I know that they do it because they were just like me. They were indoctrinated from the time they were, the vast majority of them grew up in the church. And in a lot of ways, their upbringing was even more extreme than mine was, even though the picketing didn't start until I was five. They were taught that those ideas were unquestionable. And now the hope that I have for them is that it's not that, you know, I understand why people demonize them. And I just understand that the things that changed me were compassion and empathy and grace, even when I seemed most not to deserve it. And I hope that that will change them too.
Would you say that the courage that you have came from your family, but you decided how to use it?
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your life now, because it's pretty heavy right there. Tell me about your family, your kids. Tell me the fun things. Like, what do you enjoy about living right now? Because it's important for us to be in this space, and so many people are in this space with us. And now let's exhale and say, you know, we're also a couple of moms having a conversation about, you know, our kids and our siblings, some of, you know, whom you are in touch with and some not.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about Megan today.
Well, today is my daughter's first birthday, and she is just the joy of my life. Everything, I mean, I can't believe, I grew up at the church, you know, since the church is mostly my family, I came to believe that I would never get married or have children. And so now to have this wonderful husband, who you will also read about in the book, he was one of the people that I met on Twitter, who helped change my mind. And so to have him and our daughter is just a wonderful, wonderful thing that I'm so grateful for. I feel like I don't deserve, you know, any good thing. I mean, I deeply have that feeling. And so the fact that...
I disagree with that.
Thank you. But
I believe that you deserve every good. I believe that you're worthy.
Thank you.
Maybe you need to hear that a bunch of times from a bunch of different people.
I mean, it just makes me feel so much gratitude for every good thing that is in my life and every good person. So,
What kind of mother are you to her? Because your mother is incredibly affectionate and loving, and yet sometimes not the person that you want to stand up and defy. Tell me what kind of mom that you are and want to be as your child grows.
there is a lot about my mother that I want to be for my daughter. You know, when I got pregnant, there was definitely a part of me that felt like I could just kind of go very inward and you know, slow down, you know, and try not to do too much and things like that. And then I thought about my mom. My mom, you know, I'm the third of 11 children. And so, you know, my mom was constantly pregnant when I was growing up. And she would, you know, she got morning sickness and had all the problems that, you know, any, you know, pregnant woman has. And, you know, she would be giving me my walking orders, going around the house, telling me all the things that I needed to get done. Pause 1 second, go and vomit, and then come back. And I mean, and she just, nothing slowed her down. And I absolutely want to, you know, be that same kind of example for my daughter. One thing that I have to, like, have, you know, in my own mind all the time is that, you know, I'm not raising her to be my daughter or a member of a church or some, I'm raising her to be her own person and she's going to have to grow up and live her own life.
The book is called Unfollow, A Memoir of Loving and Leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. My guest has been the very brave and talented Megan Phelps Roper. I love you. Thank you for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.